Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Waisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right. Credit where it's due. And according to KFF Health News, we got to give some kudos to Reddit.
Oh, okay.
With reason, right? Specifically, okay. A new diagnosis is bubbling up across the nation in large part thanks to Reddit. And it all started with, or at least this article kicks off with, a video that was posted to Reddit this summer. A person named Lucy Rosenthal, her face starts looking all focused and uncertain. She looks into the camera and then suddenly she belches. And then it's wide-eyed surprise and rollicking laughter. I got it, the Denver resident says after what was her second burp ever. So Rosenthal is among more than 1,000 people who have received a procedure to help them burp since 2019, when an Illinois doctor first reported the steps of the intervention in a medical journal. Now, it sounds kind of funny because haha burping, but the inability to belch can cause serious issues like bloating, pain, gurgling in the neck and chest, and of course, excessive flatulence because built-up air is going to seek an alternate route.
Right. It's got to go somewhere.
Yes. So membership in a subreddit for people with or interested in the condition, it's ballooned to about 31,000 people. And since 2019, the condition has had an official name. Retrograde cricopharyngeal dysfunction. Now, it's caused by a quirk in the muscle that acts as the gatekeeper to the esophagus. The procedure to fix it? It's a Botox injection.
Oh, just loosens that muscle. Okay.
Right. And the physician who treated Rosenthal said he hadn't even heard of the disorder until 2020, when a teenager armed with a list of academic papers found on Reddit asked him to do the procedure.
Wow.
Yeah, that's American healthcare for you.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It sucks.
But it wasn't much of a stretch because the physician he went to, Michael King, a laryngologist with Peak ENT and Voice Center, he had already been doing Botox injections in the same muscle, but to treat people who have a hard time swallowing after a stroke.
Oh, okay.
So it had already been done, just not for this particular application. But now he's among doctors from Norway to Thailand who are listed on the subreddit. If you want to check it out for yourself, it's called No Burp. So that teenager, the pioneering patient that we talked about, that is one Daryl Moody. And he said that in 2015, he had become desperate for relief. The bloating and gurgling was cramping a new hobby that he had discovered, which was skydiving.
Oh.
Quote, I hadn't done anything fun or interesting with my life until he tried skydiving. But if you're a no burper, what happens is that your stomach will inflate because of that altitude. And for him, he just couldn't do it.
Yeah, it's painful.
Yeah.
But then he stumbled on a YouTube video by Bastian, the earlier doctor, describing how Botox injections can fix some throat conditions, like the can't swallow after stroke, right? And so Moody asked if Bastian could try it to cure his burping problem. Bastian agreed to give it a shot. Of course, Moody's insurance considered it, quote, experimental and unnecessary.
Sure.
So he had to pay about $2,700 out of pocket, which is, by American standards, reasonable for some.
Yeah, honestly, anything that involves anesthesia, that's a bargain. He did fine.
Yeah, I'm just imagining the Simpsons doctor now. Like, yeah, I'll Botox your stomach.
That's right.
Why not? Let's give it a try.
Why not?
Thanks, Dr. Nick. But he knew that this was going to change everything in his life, or he at least had been hoping. And in fact, the year after this procedure, Moody helped break a national record for participating in the largest group of people skydiving together while wearing wingsuits. And if you're not familiar with those wingsuits, are the ones that turn people into like flying squirrels.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's jumped about 400 times now.
Well, good for him. I'm glad he's able to live life to the fullest now.
Correct. And as far as doctors not understanding this as a real condition, listen, this is not new. People have been plagued with this for at least a few millennia. 2,000 years ago, Pliny the Elder. he just described a man named Pomponius, great name, who could not belch. Now, it took a few more centuries for clinical examples to pop up. In the 1980s, a few case reports in the U.S. described people who could not burp had no memory of vomiting. One woman that doctors wrote was unable to voluntarily belch along with her childhood friends when this was a popular game. Oh, the trauma. And of course, the patients were in a great deal of pain, although doctors couldn't find anything wrong with their anatomy. But the doctors did confirm, using a method called manometry, that patients' upper esophageal sphincters simply would not relax, not after a meal of a sandwich, not even after doctors used a catheter to squirt several ounces of air beneath the stubborn valve. Not sure why that would do it, but they thought it would. So André Smout, a gastroenterologist at the University of Amsterdam, said, he read those reports when they came out, but we never saw the condition, so we didn't believe that it existed in real life. So, In his case, his doubts persisted until he and his colleagues studied a small group of patients a few years ago. They gave 8 patients what they called a belch provocation, aka some carbonated water, and used pressure sensors to observe how their throats moved. And yes, the air stayed trapped. Yay, science! So at least now in the Current Opinion in Gastroenterology, a journal, he wrote this summer that the syndrome, quote, may not be as rare as thought hitherto. In fact, he credits Reddit with alerting patients and medical professionals to its existence.
Yeah, Reddit's good for some things. I mean, I won't deny it. It's all the good and all the bad, right? But it has gotten to the point where if you're searching for an answer, you got to put Reddit on the end of the search string to make sure you get a real person asking a real question.
Because Reddit has no bots.
Right. No, none.
Yeah, not a problem there either. No.
But listen, if we can teach them to belch, isn't that just better for everybody?
If the robots can belch?
Yeah.
Robo belch?
Yeah.
I mean, you could put some perfume in there, like aromatherapy or something.
Yeah, it's like a little Glade plug-in, but it's just right out of his mouth.
I would buy that. 3D printer, go. All right, next link.
Next link.
This article is from The Conversation, titled, Waking Up with a Bang, It Could Be Exploding Head Syndrome.
Oh, no!
Yeah, any of y'all have this one?
I'm familiar with it. I don't get it waking up, but in the middle of the night sometimes, I'll suddenly jolt and feel like I've heard something. It's a whole thing.
Rude!
Okay, then maybe you'll relate to this.
Yeah,
maybe
it's
this
not
is
fun.
You.
I'm not a, yeah. a fan.
So, exploding head syndrome, or EHS, belongs to a family of sleep disorders known as parasomnias. Other parasomnias include sleep paralysis and hypnic jerks, the cause of that unpleasant feeling of falling we sometimes experience when drifting off to sleep. EHS has been known to medical professionals since at least 1876, and apparently the French philosopher and scientist René Descartes experienced it. Despite that, we know surprisingly little about the condition. A typical episode is characterized by the experience of an abrupt loud noise or a sense of an explosion inside the head that occurs during the transition from wakefulness to sleep. Huh. The sounds that are heard during EHS are variable and include perceptions of gunshots, doors slamming, or nondescript screaming. I haven't heard that one yet.
Nice.
Very Munchian there.
Yeah. So importantly, the sounds that are heard are always short, a few seconds or less, very loud, and without any obvious external source in the environment. Alongside the sounds, some people experience accompanying brief visual hallucinations, such as bright flashes. Others have also reported feelings of intense heat or the sensation of electrical charge flowing through the upper body, which all this is new to me. I just thought it was the exploding noises. This makes it seem like you're jumping out of the dream world or some alternate reality, just like catching onto a snippet of it. But it's hard to estimate exactly how many people experience EHS. One reason for this is simply a lack of available data. One early study found that 11% of otherwise healthy adults experienced EHS, while another study in undergrad students found 17% of participants had experienced multiple episodes in their lifetime. But it does, however, appear to be less common than other parasomnias, such as hypnic jerks, which occur in up to 70% of people, which I thought everybody had it. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, I get this. Yeah.
I do, too. 70%. I kind of like the name for that, too. Hypnic jerk.
Yeah, it sounds kind of like a dance move or maybe a food.
Right.
So in terms of triggers, the exact cause of EHS is unknown. On a typical night, as we transition from wakefulness into sleep, activity within the reticular formation of the brain is reduced. The reticular formation is a set of brain structures that acts as an on-off switch for the brain. As reticular activity slows down in the transition to sleep, our sensory cortices that govern vision, sound, and motor movements start to shut down. These brief surges of activation are then perceived as the loud, nondescript sounds that characterize EHS. So, despite its provocative name, EHS is harmless. It is, however, important to distinguish an episode of EHS from other conditions, particularly from various types of headaches. EHS episodes are very short, several seconds, and usually there's no associated pain. That's not to say that EHS can't be a scary experience. In a recent survey, over 3,000 participants who'd experienced EHS, 45% of respondents reported moderate to severe levels of fear associated with their EHS.
Yeah, that's to me makes sense. If I pop a balloon right next to your face, it's going to kind of give you a stressful moment there.
Yeah, especially when you're like trying to sleep and you didn't know there was a balloon.
Right. And now you're left struggling to figure out, wait a second, there's nothing around me. What's going on? Like there's a certain panic in not being able to identify the thing that you definitely just heard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And especially if it's like a scream nondescriptly right in your ear. That's upsetting. So, unfortunately, there have been no systematic studies investigating potential treatments and coping strategies for those struggling with the distressing experience of EHS. But, encouragingly, simply learning that EHS is a common and harmless condition can go a long way. In a patient case study, it was reported that reassurance and education about the experience stopped the episodes from happening.
I should just calm down, huh?
Yeah.
Just relax.
Next link.
Next link.
Okay, so there is a ton of mystery to the Easter Island. And to add to it, this comes from livescience.com. Easter Island's population never collapsed, but it did have contact with Native Americans, DNA study suggests.
Huh.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
The remote Pacific island of Rapa Nui, commonly known as Easter Island, never experienced a, quote, self-inflicted population collapse, according to a new analysis of ancient DNA. Researchers have long debated whether the population plummeted due to deforestation, overexploitation of local resources, and warfare during the 1600s before the arrival of Europeans a century later, or due to ancient aliens, of course. But now, after studying the genome of 15 inhabitants of the Polynesian island, researchers think that there was never a rapid drop after all. For the analysis, the team received approval from Rapa Nui representatives to study human remains at a museum close by in France. That's where the bodies were. Yeah. The bodies had been removed from the island, which is located 2,300 miles west of the mainland of Chile. So it's just right in the middle of the Pacific. DNA taken from these 15 historical individuals showed that there was no evidence of a genetic bottleneck. That would have signified a collapse in the 17th century, because when there's a collapse, they'll lose their genetic diversity.
Yeah, people start to inbreed because they have to.
Right. Instead, the DNA evidence revealed that the island's small population steadily increased until 1860, when Peruvian slave raids took over the island and decreased the population by one-third. The study concludes that there were never more than 3,000 people living on the island, a number close to that observed by the first colonizers and far from the previous estimate of 15,000 inhabitants.
Why did we ever think it was that many, do they say?
I think it's because of the Moai. And we can't think that a small population could have done
right.
Such
so it's like it must have been a ton of people. Okay.
It must have been. Yeah.
It's incompatible with the Western imperial materialist view of savages inferior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So here's the crazy part, too. The analysis also showed that individuals in Rapa Nui today have Native American DNA. Researchers think this mixing would have taken place sometimes between 1250 AD and 1430. The finding is supported by a 2020 genetic analysis, which found that Polynesians and indigenous people from Colombia hooked up about 800 years ago. This discovery offers evidence that the Rapa Nui may have been crossing the Pacific Ocean and visiting the Americas.
Yeah, that's a long boat trip, man.
It's a long boat trip, but it was a long boat trip to get there from the start.
Sure.
So, however, researchers said more analysis is necessary to know about the circumstances. For instance, it's also possible that the Native Americans journeyed to Rapa Nui. So either they sailed to Colombia and back again, or the Colombians sailed to them and couldn't get back.
Right, and never left. Yeah.
Okay, so this being archaeology, there are, of course, conflicting views. Mm-hmm. Like the one from Joanne Van Tilburg, who wasn't involved in the study but looked at it. Her main argument is that the 15 bones they studied were among hundreds removed post-European contact. Those collected have no proper documentation, and only a few crania in similar collections have been traced by multiple researchers.
So they're like, you could have just mixed up the boxes. You had a normal Native American box next to it, and you grabbed the wrong cranium.
So the DNA evidence is still there with the modern population. So that's how they can track that, right? But there's still some mixing up of the bones. So that's why she was like, I wouldn't be 100% on this. Mm-hmm. Also, remember, that island's 2,300 miles away.
So far.
Yeah.
Pre-GPS, on tiny little boats in the massive Pacific Ocean. Just, humans are remarkable.
Yeah.
And so are the ancient aliens.
Or they weren't remarkable, and ancient aliens is responsible for all of this.
Hey, look, both can be true. Why else would the ancient aliens come if we were not remarkable? Huh?
That's right. Hmm? They said, these people are worthy of the teleportation technology.
That's
Nobody
it.
Modern. Nobody.
Now you're thinking like, yep.
And on that note, next link.
Next link.
All right, this next article comes from Ad Astra, and it's called, Can Boeing Starliner Astronauts Vote from the ISS?
Oh, boy.
They get a vote?
Well, yeah, we actually haven't talked about the Boeing Starliner Astronauts yet on this podcast, which is kind of weird, but I think it's mostly because the story has been so prominent that it sort of feels like everybody already knows what's going on. But in case you don't, there are currently two astronauts, Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams, who arrived on the International Space Station back in June aboard the Boeing Starliner and were scheduled to return after an 8-day mission. Instead, the Starliner had a bunch of malfunctions, which weren't catastrophic, but were not ideal, and everyone agreed that it wasn't safe for them to return home in that same craft. I shouldn't say everyone. Boeing kept insisting that it was fine. But everyone else was like, it's not fine. And it turns out maybe Boeing was kind of right, because the Starliner itself did actually come safely back to Earth empty just a couple weeks ago, which I think it's got to be a little bit of a thorn in the side of these two astronauts, you know, because if you're going to say it's not safe, you kind of want to feel justified in that decision by watching it blow up. But it didn't blow up. They're still up there. And as of right now, the plan is for them to come back on a SpaceX flight scheduled for February of 2025. And there are plenty of complications that arise when you plan to go to space for 8 days and end up staying for 8 months. But one of those complications is that Wilmore and Williams will now be in space for the United States general election on November 5th. So the question is, will they be allowed to vote?
Oh, that vote. I thought, were they allowed to vote whether they got to come home again?
Oh, like the choice of when to go home. Yeah.
Right.
The answer to that is pretty clearly no. They didn't.
No, right. That's why I said in the beginning, they get to vote?
Right.
Oh. Okay.
So there is actually a system in place for astronauts to vote in a political election from space. The first time any American attempted it was in 1996, when astronaut John Blaha was serving aboard the Russian space station Mir, and he requested permission to vote in the presidential election that year. So NASA made a plan for him to communicate his vote electronically to someone on the ground. But the Texas Secretary of State at that time put a stop to it because the entire concept of electronic voting was relatively new, and Texas had no provision to allow for it. Like, it wasn't really about the astronaut. It was about this idea that, well, if he's going to be voting electronically, who else might demand the right to vote electronically? And we really don't want to step into that mess right now.
Yeah, then our service people will vote electronically. We don't want our military voting electronically. Yep. That'd be terrible.
Pretty much, yeah. It's also worth noting that, like almost everything else in space, the Russians got it working long before we did. Cosmonauts had been voting from space since the 1970s, though it wasn't until 1989 that they were allowed to vote for anyone who wasn't a communist.
Right. It's like, I want Yeltsin. I'm sorry, you said Khrushchev? Yeltsin. You said Khrushchev?
That's okay, what I'm hearing. Yeah. Anyway, because Blaha was ultimately denied the right to vote in 1996, there was a big push to change the law. And in 1997, a new statute was signed by then-Governor George W. Bush, outlining exactly how astronauts and only astronauts could vote electronically from space. This was immediately put to the test by David Wolf, also aboard the Mir space station, to vote in a local Houston election, since, of course, it was no longer a presidential election year by that time. And while it's true that most of this stuff is happening in Texas because that's where the Johnson Space Center is, so that's where most astronauts establish residency, some astronauts do maintain their voter registration in other states, and NASA has worked with those states on a case-by-case basis as needed over the last 25 years. Because at the end of the day, it's a really bad look to deny a highly publicized all-American hero like an astronaut the right to vote, and everybody generally wants to make it happen if they can. But then you also get situations like in 1996 where somebody has to say, listen, I'd love to, but the law is the law. And this is where it starts to look not so good for Wilmore and Williams. Because the way the Texas legislature made it work when they wrote the new law to accommodate astronauts, it's sort of a modified absentee ballot. And just like a member of the military who is mailing in their vote from overseas, astronauts must officially request their absentee ballot in advance by filling out an FPCA or federal postcard application, which will then be approved by their local county election office.
That's right. Give them more paperwork. That's
well, they can't do the paperwork in space. I got a plan. We send one of the Amazon ships up there.
Yeah, yeah. Who do you trust more, Boeing or Amazon?
Oh, boy.
But yes, like a lot of government forms, there is still no electronic version of the FPCA. It's just a piece of paper that requires a wet signature. And Wilmore and Williams did not sign that form before they left because, of course, they had no idea they'd still be up there in November. So having laid all this out, Ad Astra contacted NASA to ask what was going to happen. And apologies for the anticlimax, but NASA said, yeah, it's going to be fine. They got approval from the county clerk for a remote signature on the form, and Wilmore and Williams will be able to cast their votes alongside their crewmates. But it's a relevant issue, I think, going forward. You know, we're going to have more and more people in space as time goes on.
Or just maybe not able to get to the poles.
Yeah, but listen, this is all still very astronaut specific. Because like you said, with military members, this is the only situation where you can be both remote and electronic. Military members cannot be electronic because it's not hard to see how remote electronic voting could be a real problem in some certain countries. So I get why they want to keep a lid on this. But also, at some point, there's going to be a lot of people on our, you know, moon lava tube colony or whatever. And they're going to have to make a decision about how they're going to handle that.
They should just make it the law so that if the ISS goes over the state you're voting in, then you're allowed to do it.
Right, right, right.
5 seconds. You got
a short window. Let's go.
Go.
Next link.
Next link.
All right, some good news from the University of Florida. Some gene therapy has restored vision in the first ever trial for a rare inherited type of blindness.
Yay.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And this is a very small sample size because we are focusing on a very specific type of genetic blindness known as Leber congenital amaurosis type 1. Now, those who received the highest dose of the gene therapy saw up to a 10,000-fold improvement in light sensitivity.
Wow.
And for many patients, it was akin to finally turning on dim lights after trying to navigate their homes in the pitch black for years. Now, this trial also tested the safety profile of the treatment, as you should. The side effects were largely limited to minor surgical complications, and the gene therapy itself, just mild inflammation treatable with steroids.
Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. Now, this is caused by having two defective copies of GUCY2D is the name of the gene. It's required for the light-sensitive cells in the eyes to function properly, and people with the disease tend to have severely impaired vision that makes it difficult or impossible to drive, read, or even navigate the world visually. Shannon Boy has been developing the gene therapy targeting LCI1 for more than 20 years since she enrolled as a grad student at UF in 2001. Her lab developed the virus-based transport system, and it's essential for delivering functioning copies of the GUCY2D gene into the correct cells in the eyes. According to Sanford Boy, most pharmaceutical companies are not interested in treating these rare diseases because they are not strong revenue generators. But we think these patients deserve attention because we have treatments that work and provide really meaningful improvements to their quality of life. So for the study, they enrolled 15 subjects for treatment at the University of Pennsylvania or at Oregon Health and Science University. Subjects received one of three different doses of the therapy because they're trying to identify the safest and most effective dose for future trials. All patients received the treatment in one eye, which involved, deep breath, a surgical injection in the retina.
Okay. Yeah, that's generally okay.
Didn't you have LASIK? Isn't that kind of the same?
Yeah. But it was a knife and a flap and not...
I don't know. I think I'd prefer a needle to a knife.
I'll be totally honest with you. They gave me a Valium or a Xanax beforehand, which was the right move because I can't really... apparently, they videotaped it if I wanted to... Nope, I don't want to.
No, thank you.
Here's a wild stat they just kind of buried at the bottom here. So far, they have seen visual improvements last at least 5 years, which is...
Wow.
Right? Like, you can see why that would be a non-revenue generator for the pharma companies, but as far as what science should be doing, what a brass ring.
Well, and now these people can be contributing members of society. Like, from a larger standpoint, you want people in the workforce. Now they are not a drain on the social system.
Exactly.
So even if the medical system's not making money off it, the population is.
Yeah, you can absolutely make a late-stage capitalism explanation for justifying
this. I'm just saying, if that's the framework you're coming from, at least stay consistent within that framework and acknowledge that there are benefits.
Preach it to the choir. So broad access to the treatment, it is going to require approval by the FDA. They're going to look at a phase 3 clinical trial, which will test the therapy in a larger population of patients, but fingers crossed, get it out there and get all them rare diseases gene spliced. X-Men. Okay, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from The Guardian. Ig Nobel Prize goes to team who found mammals can breathe through anuses.
Nice.
Oh, boy.
I love the Ig Nobel Prizes.
Yeah. This is my first time learning about them, so it was very entertaining. So after a series of tests on mice, rats, and pigs, Japanese scientists found that animals absorb oxygen delivered through the rectum.
Oh, it's because it was Japanese scientists. I'm sorry.
The way that I said it did make it seem like the Japanese scientists were included in that set. But no, they were doing the study. This is work that underpins a clinical trial to see whether the procedure can treat respiratory failure. So laugh all you want. We're saving lives over here, okay?
Amen.
Yeah.
The team is among 10 recognized in this year's Ig Nobel Awards, the irreverent accolades given for achievements that, quote, first make people laugh and then make them think. They are not to be confused with the more lucrative and career-changing Nobel Prizes to be handed out in Scandinavia next month. But the latest crop of Ig Nobel winners received their awards at a ceremony at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology on Thursday. The event featured real Nobel laureates to distribute the prizes, 24/7 lectures in which experts first explain their subject in 24 seconds, then in 7 words, and copious paper plane throwing. There's no more context
that
about that.
Sounds fun, actually.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like a hoot. Like, I would love that. I'm sure I could come up with some kind of weird science. I don't know.
Well, yeah, the entire thing has always been, like, we're making fun of ourselves and the scientific community and whatever, but they've always done a really good job of picking things that actually did contribute something.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, no, your study sounds insane, but actually was kind of helpful, so we're going to celebrate that.
There you go.
And it's the IG? Is what you said?
Uh-huh, IG. Yeah.
Do we know what that stands for?
No, it's like the word ignoble, like the opposite of noble.
Oh, okay. It's not, I got it. Okay.
Oh,
okay.
I didn't get that. I thought it was just some guy named Ig, and it was like, well, he's got a wacky name too, so it just works out that he was a scientist.
Yeah, internal genetics or something like that.
No. Nothing so special. It's just...
Got it.
The Japanese researchers became interested in whether humans with breathing difficulties might benefit from having oxygen pumped up their backsides after noting that some animals, such as loaches, can use their intestines to breathe. They began the work in the COVID crisis when many hospitals were desperately short of mechanical ventilators to support breathing in people with severe infections.
Mm.
Dr. Takanori Takibi confessed to mixed feelings on hearing of the award, but warmed to it on finding out it was recognized for making people laugh and then think.
Mm-hmm.
If it fueled interest in enteral ventilation, he said, I'd be so happy. The team is now running a phase 1 trial in human volunteers. So other work honored on the night included U.S. research to house pigeons in missiles to help guide them to their targets, UK investigations, which found that claims of extreme old age tend to come from areas that have short average lifespans and a historical lack of birth certificates, and a French study, which found that scalp hair tends to whirl in a clockwise direction, though less so in the southern hemisphere.
Like toilet water?
Yeah, I guess so. Botany was given to Jacob White for reporting evidence that the South American plant Bokila trifoliolata can mimic the leaves of plastic plants it is placed alongside, leading them to conclude that plant vision is a plausible hypothesis.
Whoa.
Yeah, there's a lot of very interesting stuff in this.
Yeah, it's not all butt breathing.
Yeah. Medicine was won by a Swiss, German, and Belgian group for demonstrating that fake medicine that causes painful side effects can be more effective in patients than fake medicine that does not cause painful side effects.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, in physics, awarded to James Liao at the University of Florida for a comprehensive investigation into the swimming abilities of a dead trout. There is a link to that in this article. There's links to all this stuff.
You said dead trout? Was that a Monty Python sketch?
It's literally about dead trout, so...
And their swimming abilities?
Yeah.
I guess they still swim after death.
You're gonna have to click the link to find out, y'all. That's what these are for.
In probability, this award was shared by a team of 50 researchers, mostly Dutch, who flipped 350,757 coins to test a hypothesis put forward by Percy Diaconis that tossed coins are slightly more likely to land the same way up as they started. Chemistry, another win for the Netherlands, with a team in Amsterdam using chromatography to separate drunk and sober worms, all in the name of polymer science.
Which worm is drunk?
They're just giving it a roadside test. They say, touch your nose, walk in a line, recite the alphabet backwards. All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include The Cost of Lightning, The Golden Age of Offbeat Arctic Research, and Mars Leaks Faster When Closer to the Sun. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at Patreon.com/DamnInterestingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.